Today is February 25th. This is the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Resources. We're continuing a public hearing today. We're hearing House Bill 5026, Department of Human Services. Ms. Byerly, please describe the agenda.
Members of the subcommittee, this morning, Department of Human Services is back for you again this time to talk about the self-sufficiency program.
Thank you. Ms. Kelly Seal.
Good morning, Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Bates, members of the committee. My name is Erin Kelly Seal. I am the director of the Department of Human Services. I currently am without a director for our self-sufficiency programs, and so I'll be presenting for you today. We are in the middle of recruitment. We've had a first round of interviews, and we're actively moving toward creating a new face for this presentation as we go forward. With me today is Jerry Weybrandt. Jerry is the Chief Operating Officer for both the Self-Sufficiency and Child Welfare Program, so you'll see him tomorrow as well. And of course, Eric Moore, who is our Chief Financial Officer. So good morning. This is just a general overview of what you're going to hear from us a little bit about today. We're going to talk a little bit about the program, what we do, demographic trends in Oregon that are influencing this particular body of work, and ultimately our goal of creating pathways for people out of poverty and into self-reliance, and a little bit more about our TANF reinvestment proposal, which is a big piece of our budget that will be, we hope, a long-term discussion for both the policy and budget committees this session. And of course, the budget overview. In general, the programs that we call self-sufficiency programs within the Department of Human Services actually have some common themes, but there are several of them. It's a large group of programs together that serve about 1 million people. We'll talk more about specifically how many in each program as we go. But I think one thing to just keep in mind is that most of these programs are specifically focusing on people with limited incomes, people who are experiencing poverty. Most of these programs are designed with the goal of being temporary, programs that people are able to use as a backup, a safety net is often what we refer to them as, on a temporary basis, hopefully as they are able to move from their limited income situation to an income that they can use to support themselves and their families. Many of these programs are actually also prevention programs in many respects. When you talk to the public safety community, Representative Peluso adamantly talks about the fact that these programs, in her view as a former sheriff, are prevention programs. They create opportunities for stability that then create opportunities for more safety. We know that to be true around issues affecting children. We actually track in Oregon the number of children in the foster care system who previously were on TANF. We see the opportunity in TANF to help prevent and stop that entry into foster care for some of those families. The Domestic Violence Emergency Assistance Program is a program that prevents further harm to domestic violence survivors and their kids. And these programs often are the only thing between someone being very, very hungry and homeless. And so in many respects, these programs actually prevent outcomes that can be worse for people in their lives. And I want to just emphasize, too, you'll hear a lot from us today about the fact that as the economy is in recovery, we're increasingly trying through these programs to emphasize the opportunity to connect individuals to employment and skills training. So that's something that you're going to see us talk more about as we go. What's happening in Oregon today in terms of poverty? This just gives you a sense of poverty rates by county in the state. The national poverty rate, just by comparison for you, is 14.5%. But this will show you, based on color, purple are the two counties that have the most poverty in them, Wheeler and Malheur County. The darker blue, and all the way to green, and you can see the poverty levels as you go, very uneven in terms of distribution. And I just would remind you that a little bit about the poverty level. For a family of three, the 2015 poverty level is $20,090 per year. That's about $1,675 a month for that family. for each additional person in the household, we can get you a chart if you're interested. It's also easy to Google and find on the web around kind of where the poverty levels are shaking out today, but that's what we're referring to here in this chart. That poverty rate was set in the 1960s. It really is a measure around the cost of food, and there are lots of debates about how inadequate a measure it is or how outdated a measure is probably a better way of putting it, because it does not include things today like the expenses that many families have today, such as housing, the cost of childcare, transportation, things that have increased in cost exponentially for families far more so than the cost of food. So it's just something to be mindful of, but it is the rate that we use, and we do means test a lot of our programs in the self-sufficiency arena, so I wanted you to be able to see the poverty rates across the state. Children are disproportionately impacted by poverty. There are a lot of reasons for this. We have federal programs for seniors that have been put in place that have dramatically reduced rates of poverty among our older among the elderly, and frankly, the younger you are as a child, the more risk you have of being in poverty in Oregon. And that's because parents of young children tend to be younger, they have less education, less work experience, have had less opportunity to accumulate opportunity for salary and economic benefit, and frankly, kids are expensive. If you have them, you know this, and it's a time where that risk of being in poverty is higher. The drivers of poverty that we see, and this is true across the country, really have to do with education levels of parents and also the composition of the household. Those are the two risk factors that create a more likely than situation for children experiencing poverty. I want to mention, too, that not all poverty is the same. Some poverty for families is situational. It's driven by a single crisis event, a divorce, a medical issue, something that happens, and the experience can be intermittent or something that is not a permanent situation for the family. And in other instances, their economic hardship is more chronic. So just something to keep in mind as we're thinking about our programs that intervene and what that looks like and how we customize our intervention based on the experience that people are having.
Madam Chair, yes, Senator Winters.
A quick question, and you may not have to get back to us on the answer, and that's whether or not you have any information to share with us as to how the program that's being done by Catholic Charities that talks about, you know, neighborhood crisis intervention to assist families for situational crisis. And I don't know whether you're tracking that one or not, and whether you have any conclusion as to how successful that is, that program is.
Coacher Nathanson, Senator Winters, I'll have to look into it further and find out more about it. I had a conversation with their director when they were implementing the program, but I haven't been tracking where they've been in terms of their results. I'd be happy to get more information for the committee.
Thank you.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Aaron, I'm just, you just said something that caught my attention. Not all poverty is the same. And then you described the situational, which I describe as events that occur in the family that cause them to be where they're at, versus that of the economic environment that they're in. I just got to walk away from that saying poverty is poverty. There might be different. I mean, we can argue on that and all that, but I'm just thinking to myself, poverty is poverty.
At Co-Chairs, Representative Olson, I agree that poverty is harmful. The next slide I'm going to talk about will describe that. The effect can be different, and I think what I meant to suggest by making that observation is that the types and levels and degrees of intervention, we are hoping to be able to create programs that are flexible enough to be tailored to in different ways depending on the individual circumstance of the family. In other words, one size doesn't fit all. During the recession, we certainly had the experience that many people who had never had been so challenged in terms of their income levels were having a first-time experience with some of our services. The interaction with those individuals and the way to meet their needs was a very different type of interaction than has been our experience sometimes with individuals who are more familiar with navigating the services, who've had to depend on the services for longer periods of time. So really, for me, was more a reflection on our ability to provide a customer service that is more responsive, more flexible, and more tailored to the individual. I think the other thing that I didn't say that I meant to when I talked about just the variation or the diversity among the poverty experience, for some families, poverty is merely an economic experience. It's really about economic hardship. For others, that experience is compounded by social isolation. They're lacking in social capital, skills, connections, community. And there again, the type of intervention that's needed can be really different depending on the family's circumstances and their willingness to engage.
Chair, yes.
I'd like to put a finer point on that, if you could, for us. Two things: can you tell us at a later time the percentage of children presently in Oregon who are in poverty? Well, you get numbers here from 2011, and I appreciate that. But I'd like to know what percentage of children in Oregon are still in poverty. You may have that, you may not have that, but it would be helpful for other committees too. The other thing I think you were alluding to is during the recession, when we looked at poverty, we saw some very unusual things. We saw people in their 40s and 50s who had never ever touched the system before, who had lost their jobs in the recession and actually dropped into poverty, lost their homes, and we had families in which people had been bankers and realtors and well into the middle class, burned through their savings in a year, end up losing their homes and really facing homelessness, and that's a part of a population we have never seen before. And I don't know what's happened to that slice of people, if the recession has resolved some of this or what's happened to them, and I'd like to take a look at that. You may remember looking at those figures with us. It was really very revealing and kind of shocking and very sad. So I'd like to see that information, if you can get it again for us, too.
Commissioner Bates, we will follow up. In Chair Kenny Geyer's committee, I presented the child poverty statistic, and it's not coming to mind immediately right this minute, but I'll get back to you on that. And I would also, we do have some observations later in the presentation that talk about the recession and the changes and the services. Again, though, I think for those individuals who had a first-time experience with us, their outcomes have varied depending on where they started in terms of their assets, their social capital, et cetera, when they came into the programs, and then their level of skill and their ability to be retrained and become employed again. And so we're happy to continue that conversation with you as well.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, while you're getting data information for us, would you add to the children poverty request that Dr. Bates requested, If you could do a couple things with that data, and that's provide us with the ethnic breakdown of that data, as well as the data that you mentioned some in the document of single parents, and actually give us what universe we're talking about. I'd just like you to expand on the data set so that we actually have a better understanding of the profiles of the individuals. And along with it, because we don't tend to actually add those to the category of poverty, but if you would you include the number of abuse and neglect cases in Oregon?
Co-chairs, Senator Winters, we will provide that information for you, and tomorrow you'll see more information. But what I'm hearing you ask for, let me make sure I can repeat it back, is looking at perhaps the poverty rate by county and then the rate of abuse and neglect in each county so that you can see them together?
Yes.
Is that correct? Okay.
Yes.
As an interesting aside, one quick thing you may want to Google is that the Children's Trust Fund for Oregon has done some really good studies of late around evidence-based child abuse and neglect prevention programs, and they've looked at, similar to what the senator is requesting, rates of risk, including poverty, in communities across Oregon, rates of child abuse and neglect, and then they've taken a look at, in a second report, the programs available in those communities that are evidence-based that are targeted to child abuse and neglect prevention. They have some great maps on their website and in those studies, so if you felt like Googling the Children's Trust Fund for Oregon, you could have access to that information pretty easily, or we can provide the links to you as well in our responses so you can find them. So just also to One last point in terms of these programs as prevention programs. We know that investment in ameliorating the effects of poverty early in and also throughout life, but especially for children, has a long-term impact on the budget of Oregon. When you look at the impact that economic hardship can have on child development and the prospect for an individual's future, it's hugely impactful. And so again, to that point of when you think about corrections, when you think about the youth authority, the cost to the foster care system, some of our more expensive response systems, and we're actually doing this analysis, we talked about this in the committee previously, we have an opportunity, we believe, early in these programs and in these young people's lives and in these families' lives to have an impact that can actually flip this conversation on its head and do things like improve school readiness and therefore decrease the chance that someone costs more later to the state in other systems. So we had a great presentation last week. Oregon State University brought in some educators, and I believe some legislators met with them too, around two generation impact programs. These are conversations we're having with the Early Learning Council, Department of Human Services, and the Oregon Health Authority, opportunities for us to work together to have this multi-generation impact with programs like the ones you're going to hear about today, and leveraging programs also that are administered by other organizations to basically reverse this slide and turn it on its head so that we can see better results in the long term. So our role in this, more specifically coming back down to the program itself, you can see just the impact of each program area. Some of these programs are much smaller than others. We support people who are resettling in this country as refugees through federal funded programs and services, all the way to the subsidized child care program and many things in between. Our programs are, for the most part, dependent, to qualify for them depends on your income level. And there are different income levels for different programs. We did send over, I believe yesterday or the day before, the matrix of eligibility that you requested. And so in that matrix, you can see more than just the programs that are in the self-sufficiency arena. We chose the three largest here to show you, just so that you had a visual and could see the income levels that are required in order to qualify for employment-related daycare and SNAP, which obviously are much higher than the income level for qualification for the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program. And if you go back to the previous slide, you can also see then the number of people served and relative to those monthly income levels.
Can I ask a question? Yes. On the slide, serving 1 million people annually, you have two on the bottom, the two purple TANF ones. It says jobs. I was wondering if those are overlaps at all between the two TANF assistants.
Co-chairs and Representative Boone, they are. The 23,814 people that receive job services are also receiving cash assistance. The program has two parts to it. There are some individuals, mostly child-only cases, that are children that are living with relatives, and the relative is receiving a cash payment for the child, that are not mandatory to participate in the jobs program. So the numbers, that's why the numbers look different.
But follow-up. Okay. Good. In order to receive TANF cash, you have to do a job if there's a child. Is that what you're saying? I don't follow that. If the child is with their family, their parents, then they qualify for the jobs assistance too, or they don't. I mean, I wasn't sure what you said.
Co-chairs and Representative Boone, typically, when a family is qualifying, and depending on their circumstances, and there are some minimal exceptions to this around domestic violence or other things, they become what is called a mandatory jobs participant, which means that in order to receive the cash assistance, they need to be actively looking for work. TANF is a time-limited program. It's driven a lot by federal regulation and also then quite a bit by state statute. And so, yes, when a parent comes to us and says, I believe I qualify for the program, or we determine when they're looking for food that they may qualify for the program. And kind of back to that next slide, they have to be extremely low income, living in extreme poverty, in order to qualify if they have children. When they enroll in the service, they receive a monthly cash supplement. We'll talk more about that later. But they also then, as a parent, have to begin engaging with us around going back to work.
Mm-hmm. But then follow up again. If the child is, say, removed from that home and put in with an auntie or grandma or something, that grandma can get the 10 of cash assistance but is not required to qualify for the jobs. Is that right?
Co-chairs, Representative Boone, that's right. If they qualify for a child-only case, which has eligibility criteria in and of itself, and they're living with a relative, the relative isn't considered a mandatory jobs participant because the child is technically receiving the benefit, and the child is not of working age.
Can I follow up on that, Madam Chair? Thank you. Just spin off, Aaron or Jerry, on this is actually a live scenario that I'm going to share with you, that I'm going to kind of develop off that. You just mentioned to engage with your agency to return back to work for, you know, notifying them what's going on for the benefits, so benefits come to an end, right? Oh, okay, well, I'm just, all right, let's, if an individual, a mom with, let's say, two kids, begins to receive SNAP and also begins to receive TANF for a certain time period, she returns back to work and no longer is under the poverty level, but has actually been hired, let's say, and got a great job. She comes back in. She's required to have to notify your agency of the change. So that's your engagement from her to you on where she's at for what's happening for her economically, you know, and for wages. What is the responsibility of your agency at that point then to just say, thank you, and we're going to discontinue your benefits? I mean, how does that work? That's what I'm trying to kind of walk through and figure out. Because I got to tell you, that's not what happened with this one incident that I'm alluding to. Because she called a local office and they said, just go ahead and finish out using what you have on your card. And that to me didn't make sense. But that's what I'm trying to kind of figure out.
Co-chairs and Representative Olson, I'd be happy to take this offline on the specific case, because there's program benefits or rule. Actually, there's rules connected to both federal and state statute around what their eligibility is, and those may be different depending on what the benefit is that you're talking about. For example, on the SNAP benefit, I believe that benefit is granted for that month. So if you get employment, that remains on your card and you can use that. And so it could be that you're talking about a SNAP benefit that she had, and that's so that when the person engages in employment and they're waiting for the first paycheck, they still have the money available to use to feed their families waiting to be paid. But I'd be happy to engage afterwards around this situation if that would be helpful.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Is it on this slide?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well,
okay.
The last slide.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I'm looking at the jobs and the TANF mm-hmm. assistance for the number of families. To my understanding, the proposed $30 million TANF reinvestment that has kind of been talked about a little bit would take that $30 million and focus it on the jobs portion of TANF. If that's correct, well, if it's incorrect, please correct me and tell me what the focus of that $30 million reinvest would be. And what would that change the number of jobs, people and services? How would that actually change the jobs portion of this?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Representative Stark, it's not exactly correct, and I do have several slides later where I'll go into that in more detail. Would that be okay?
Yep, that works.
And if I don't answer your question, then I'll try and come back to it.
That's okay.
Madam Chair, just quickly.
Senator Winters down there.
Can you bring us back? You know, we always get the number of how many current cases that we have. Can you also bring us the number of closed cases? you know, what has occurred during this last biennium or this last year, you know, from open to close. So to get a sense of how much you've worked on and how much you've actually have completed the process and they no longer require the service of the agency.
Co-Chair Senator Winters, we will do that for the TANF program specifically.
Well, I think TANF and those that are part of the, you know, you've got a large number up there that you talk about how many individuals that you serve, and it would be nice to know in that service area how many that's open and how many that's closed, which gives us an understanding of the work that's actually being done in the agency, that, you know, you're not just opening cases, you're actually, you know, getting individuals to where they need to be, and those cases then become a closed case.
Thank you for the question. We'll follow up.
It's called success.
I appreciate the opportunity to share that. And I think what it will also highlight for you, and I know we've talked about this a little bit before on medical programs, is some of the on and off of the program, the churn, if you will. And again, back to that, sometimes someone will have a job for a period of time, they won't qualify for the program, they lose that job experience, and they end up coming back into the program when they no longer have that income. This slide gives you a sense of the caseload increase that took place in communities overall. This is 2007, and now you can see 2014. So I'm going to do that again for you because I had to do it for myself a couple of times. So if you look at this slide, so perhaps choose a county to focus on. It's easier to pick one. This is the caseload in terms of the self-sufficiency programs as a whole, what we were talking about in 2007, so before the recession. And this is how the caseload has changed during the economic recession. So our point is that we had fairly significant caseload increases, which is really what one would have expected. As the economy deteriorated and people had greater needs, the impact on our services increased exponentially. I went back to our self-sufficiency presentation from Ways and Means in 2013 to look at a couple points in time that we were sharing with you. Between 2007 and 2012, the increase in the SNAP program for the state was almost 90% of a caseload increase, 90%. And for the TANF program, between 2007 and 2012, the increase for the state, this is a statewide total, was almost 96%. Mm-hmm. So our staff across the state were really on the front lines of the economic crisis. They were, we often call it the period of time for us that was much like a triage or a MASH unit. People were coming in, they were waiting, and most often waiting until they were very most desperate to come in for service, qualifying. And during that period of time, I'm very proud to report that obviously this committee was not able to make huge investments in staffing. We did not receive a commensurate staffing increase during that period of time. In fact, saw some staffing decreases. We were able to implement the Lean Daily Management System. Our staff became more efficient. The services that we offered were able to be provided more quickly than pre-recession levels. More effectively, we maintained accuracy rates that were about equivalent to the national level. So we didn't become less accurate. We became more timely in our service, and we helped meet people's needs where they were during the recession period. The good news is we're now seeing the other side of these curves, and when you look at the caseload trends, and I went through some of those with you on the first day of the presentation, we're now starting to see decreases in caseload in both SNAP and in the TANF program. And the TANF program caseload reduction is what's affording us the opportunity to have a conversation with you about a reinvestment of caseload savings into the program. But we're starting out from a place of significant need and significant demand for these particular sets of services. And it's something that we're looking forward to seeing go back to pre-recession levels. But even those caseload decreases that are predicted don't have us getting there in these next 2 years. The economy that is coming back is a different economy than we had in 2007. And the type of jobs, and we talked about this a little bit on that first day too, that people are able to get are not always the types of jobs that afford them to be able to no longer qualify for the programs, which is why we have such an emphasis on employment and skills training, partnerships with the workforce system, the education system, because we see our long-term future and these caseload declines in that education system and in the employment system and workforce system so that people can get jobs that pay enough so they don't longer need the benefits.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I heard what you said, but could you say it one more time, Aaron? It dealt with the 90% that you saw increase with SNAP program during that time period, and then 96% with TANF. And that was from 2007 to?
2012.
Wow. Thanks. Thank you.
So in the next few slides, we're going to highlight each program and some things that just give you a quick picture of the program itself and then some of the accomplishments. And I want to be mindful of time because I know there are pieces to this program like the TANF reinvestment piece that we may want to spend more time on. This is a basic overview of the SNAP program, who we serve, how we go about serving them, components of the program itself, and the basic outcome that we're looking to achieve for the program. I think in this slide what I would highlight for you is that is the average per person benefit on SNAP. I think sometimes the public perceives SNAP and the amount of benefits that people receive as being much higher than what actually is the case. I would highlight for you that 75% of households on SNAP, remember the eligibility criteria is at 185% of the federal poverty level, have some form of income. The last time we looked, more than 30% of families were actively working, and many of them are working part-time, and that's really the issue. They don't have full-time work.
Senator. Thank you. I would just point out as a comment that I have had a teacher in one of my school districts tell me that not SNAP, but WIC, which is also a program that serves lower-income families. So our teachers are needing to reach out for supplemental benefits when they're either expecting or have a young child, which says a little bit of something about the fact that this is not just people who don't have living, quote-unquote, wage jobs, but people who are in some of the most important professions in our state. So I didn't mean to get too far afield, Ms. Kelly Steele, but I think it's important to point out that this is not just people who aren't working by any means or people who are working in fast food.
Thank you, Co-Chair Senator Steiner Hayward. We do have two areas of emphasis on this program that we're looking to grow because this is a program, by the way, just a reminder, the benefit is 100% federal funds. The workforce is supported 50% by federal dollars, 50% by state dollars.
Aaron, I'm going to interrupt for a moment. It's 100% federally funded benefit. Staffing, you said, is 50% federally funded. And could you please describe a little bit how we're operating under federal rules? Some of the communications that we receive from constituents are questions or observations about the program, things that they disagree with, things that they're concerned about. Mm-hmm. The state, as I understand it, it cannot impose rules on what kind of food qualifies, for example, mm-hmm. for purchase.
That's a great point.
Okay. Can you describe to us our obligations mm-hmm. in using this program and whether we have the opportunity to intervene with federal rules?
Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, we actually have a one or two pager, I think it may be two pages, and we'd be happy to provide it to the committee about in response to questions that Oregonians raise with respect to what can and can't be purchased. You described correctly, this is the federal government considers us essentially a contractor around this program. They create the rules around the program, what foods qualify for purchase, which don't. And in order to make adjustments to that and even to other components of the program, the state has to seek federal waivers, and our waivers are not always approved. We have sought waivers in the past that haven't been approved in terms of things we thought would make the program easier or improve some program elements. And we've sought waivers that have been approved. I'm really proud of our federal-state partnership around this program. In fact, I'm meeting with Undersecretary Concannon this Friday to check in on the program. But it is their program, and they do create particularly, I think, I know we hear often about, you know, can which foods qualify for purchase, which don't. We also hear about how people cannot purchase things like very basic essentials such as toiletries with this benefit, and that, you know, it sort of goes both ways. Why can't you purchase? I think this actually came up in Chair Kenny Geyer's committee from Representative Hayden at one point. Why can't people purchase things like toilet paper, things that we would all consider basic? It's a food purchasing benefit. The federal government does regulate it.
Thank you.
A few highlights in terms of what our focus has been and what we're working toward with the program. We do serve a lot of people in Oregon with this program. We have received federal recognition for our administration of the program. We've also been actively working with the federal government around opportunities to leverage this program with other efforts that we're making around things like program integrity. So we've received, we're one of eight states that was awarded a federal grant to identify, track, and prevent the misuse of food benefits in Oregon trail cards. We have recently received, one of seven states to receive a grant focusing on the employment and training services. We're really looking to grow that program. Really, this is about creating income opportunity for people who are receiving SNAP benefits so that they can leave the SNAP program through higher wage work. And in that case, we're focusing on some rural communities as well as veterans and Native Americans, individuals that often end up in those low wage opportunities and struggle to get off the program.
Senator Bates.
I hadn't heard of this program. I think of this in TANF and other areas. This is in the SNAP program? Mm-hmm.
Co-Chair Senator Bates. We do, it's a smaller program, but it's one that is not something that the state invests in, but it's actually a really unique program in that when we can, when a community partner is interested in supporting employment and training services for SNAP recipients, they come to the table and with us as an agent can negotiate a match rate with the federal government. So they make a contribution. The federal government contributes to the service. We're the vehicle for the SNAP eligibility piece and knowing who the consumers will be who get served by the program. And we've been looking to expand it throughout Oregon. So there was a period of time where we just frankly didn't have the capacity, and neither did the nonprofit community, to be thinking about this, but we're now seeing renewed interest, and we have some really great partnerships with different nonprofits throughout the state, and we're looking to grow them. This grant is one opportunity for us to do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll take a conversation offline. I want to hear more about it, but I don't want to take the committee's time right now. Mm.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you. Just quick question. So you highlighted a lot of rural counties that are in poverty. But I'm always curious about the ones that come up the highest level of poverty, like Wheeler and Malheur in particular. Is there a reason why they're not? I almost never see them mentioned in targeted programs.
Co-chairs and Representative Kenny Geyer, I would make the observation that I think Malheur has one of the most active prosperity conversations actually going on right now as a state. They've got a pilot project there that Representative Cliff Bentz is helping lead. We're a part of that. It's really focusing on CET and other training capacity in that community. So I'm aware of some really targeted and excellent efforts going on in Malheur County. I think Wheeler County just typically is a smaller county and benefits from consortium opportunities more so than individually targeted one. And I think it's just simply a function of population base.
Thank you.
We've also been, so program integrity has been a real focus, if I could say, themes, the issue around this expansion of the employment and training program, and then we have a strong partnership with Oregon State University around nutrition education, and we're really looking to ramp that up as well, recognizing the connection between, you know, just the price of food, nutritious food is more costly, the time it takes to prepare it, and really wanting to be sure that SNAP recipients have opportunities to learn and benefit and be able to be, you know, able to provide as much nutritional value to their families as possible. We also have partnerships with the WIC program as well around some of their vouchers and coupon programs so that we can help particularly children and the elderly be able to benefit from some of those efforts. There are things coming up in this program. I mentioned a couple of them. I think the one thing that I did not talk about yet is that the five-year farm bill did receive approval from Congress last year and was signed by the president in 2014. There are some new requirements, things that we already are doing, and it has emphasis that are similar to those I've already mentioned in the area of I've been calling it employment training. I think it's actually education and training. I apologize. And the nutrition education programs, and we'd be happy to get you more detail on that if you're interested. I'm just trying to be mindful of time. TANF program overview. About 30,000 families served. Most families are single mothers with two children. That's just a general profile. And so we use that profile when we talk about some of the program design elements that we'll get to later. Most of the individuals who come to us and who qualify for TANF actually have zero income, but there is an income cap threshold, and it's really about 37% of the federal poverty level. Oregon has not changed that income cap threshold for many, many years, and so over time, that income cap has ended up being less and less and less in terms of relative to the federal poverty standard.
We have a question from Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. On that specific point, you know, you'll probably be there this afternoon when we're hearing about some of the different bills related to TANF, and one of the bills recommends that we increase that eligibility level to 66%, which, to my understanding, is at the time the $616 what that was. Do you have a projection on what the increased caseload would be if we increase eligibility to 66% of federal poverty level? Would it go from 30,110 to what? What's the guesstimate as to where we'd end up at?
Co-chairs, Representative Stark, I know we're working on that analysis right now. It would certainly increase the caseload if more people qualified for the program. So we can definitely we will be providing that in the context of that legislation. I don't know if we'll have it today, but we are working on that estimate for you.
Okay. Follow-up?
Yes.
Thank you. And I haven't seen, is it clear, or it's not clear to me, on the $506 per month in TANF assistance, is it that everybody who qualifies receives that full amount, or is there different amounts based off of what their income is?
Co-chairs and Representative Stark, the cash amount does differ depending on level of income and size of family.
Okay, thank you.
We use that as a basic average just to give you perspective. I think, again, to debunk the myth that we're supporting people well in the program, that cash assistance amount is actually less than obviously what it takes to qualify for the program. So I think there's often the myth that people come into TANF because they could be earning more. The last time I looked, and it may have changed, but the last time I looked, once you worked 17 hours at Oregon's minimum wage, you were no longer eligible for TANF. I hear someone whispering, it's down to 16 now. Thank you for the assistance from the audience.
Could you say that one more time, please?
Yeah. Once an individual works for 16 hours a week, they no longer qualify for the TANF benefit, and they're earning more than, clearly more than they would have at our $506 a month. So there is. You know, when you look at it on that pure dollars and cents way, there is incentive to go to work. However, we'll talk later about the benefits cliff issue and some of the impact there as well. But I just wanted to put in perspective for people just how, you know, relative to the hours worked piece and why that part-time work issue is a really important issue in the context of this program.
Madam Chair, when you come back and it would be nice to take a snapshot of a real family and include it in that when we talk about the cliff piece, but also, you know, talk about what that 506 buys. I think it would be rather startling for individuals to understand, you know, what comes out of that 506 and what's remaining, and because we don't tend to, we get all these comments coming from our communities with respect to this issue, and I think it's just nice for members to know actually what happens with the $560.
Co-Chair Nathanson, Senator Winters, thank you for the opportunity. We can take our best run at it when you just look at kind of basic expenses for a household and how far this actually gets. I think one of the other things we hear in focus groups, and there have been some really great focus group efforts sponsored by our nonprofit and community partners. Focus groups with the general public, there's a perception that many, many more people in Oregon are actually receiving TANF than are. This is, you know, less than 1% of the population that is actually benefiting from this program. If you think about it in terms of families, and then which is what I'm thinking of, so let me be really clear about that, and you think about the fact that there are 3.9 million people, a little bit of apples to oranges, but relatively small program compared to population of the state, and then also people have a tendency to imagine that the benefit amount is much greater than it is. If you ask them to estimate what they think it is, often they'll estimate double this, and they're very surprised to hear what the actual average benefit amount is for the TANF program. So there is, we are happy to provide more context and truth, especially as you're navigating some of those tougher conversations with constituents. I do want to mention there's, you know, we'll talk a little bit about this later, but there are dual purposes to this program. We've alluded to it a little bit before now. So there's the cash assistance piece, which we just spent a lot of time on, but you also invest in this program around the job opportunity and basic skills program, which is that program that focuses on education and skill development for individuals within the TANF program. During the recession, prior to the recession, that program was funded at about $100 million, if you will, over a biennia. At the current funding rate is closer to 60. So the caseload has increased, you know, by nearly 90%, and the funding available to serve people in that jobs program has decreased by nearly 50%. So just perspective around the challenge, and we'll go into why that was and why that made sense then and why we're trying to do what we're doing now as we go forward. I'm just trying to keep us moving. You can see here just the vision of that continuum of TANF services. I've talked about, you know, people coming into the program at nearly zero income. Many of these families are experiencing homelessness, domestic violence. Again, you have to have a child to qualify for the program. Often people are in crisis. So our main emphasis at the beginning is to help people become more stable and create a safe, stable environment that then facilitates their ability to talk about work readiness. And then our long-time goal is to get them into employment and look for employment opportunities that will actually pay them enough so that they can support themselves and their families. So that's what we're aiming for. And these are the service elements. Sorry, the slides are too fancy for me. Along that continuum that actually support that. So you can see the different pieces of the program and what we intend by those pieces in terms of where they fit around that life experience or the client experience. Things we've done, more people are going to work from the TANF program, which we're very proud of. We saw a huge tipping point during the recession. We had many, many months where we had under 500 people that we were actually see exit the program for work. The last month I checked, Jerry's probably got the more current statistic, but we had over 1,500 in a month going to work, and we have had more people every month over a month that are now going back to work. That's a function of two things, I believe. One is clearly the economy, and we can't take credit for that. But the other is this committee approved last biennium a repurposing of eligibility staff into case managers that now are able to spend more time helping people take advantage of that jobs program and then get into work opportunity. And so we're extremely grateful, and we've definitely seen an impact. And our workforce has felt the impact. The clients have definitely benefited from that. We're very excited to report to you that with that increase of engagement of clients and activities for clients, as well as the work rate that is now also there on the SNAP benefit side, we're seeing our participation rate go up. We'll show you a slide. We have some data about that later. And as you know, during the recession, we were not meeting the participation rate. And in this program, which is a federal block grant program, when you fail to meet that rate, there are penalties. what happened for Oregon is we were informed of the penalties for those years. They've not been assessed because we were allowed to go into a corrective action plan to demonstrate that with diligent effort and targeted effort, we could get back on track. We're happy to report that we've avoided 2 year of penalty, and we are on track to avoid 2 more years of the penalties. So we could end up in a position where only 1 year we will have some penalty, and we've been told by the federal partners that it won't be the full amount because we've made so much progress in the last 2 years since we entered into the agreement. So we plan to hold them to that.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Could you please, thank you, Madam Chair, can you please tell us what that penalty might be? What the range is?
Dollars.
Co-chairs and Representative Kinney-Geyer, I'm not sure if you mean the one that we may be assessed.
Yeah.
In the next biennium, somewhere under $7 million may come to be assessed. The total penalty amount is around $7 million, but we've been told it will be less than that. But the five-year cumulative amount of penalties was over $45 million, and so we're literally saving, we believe, about $40 million worth of penalty. 60. Thank you. There are a lot of numbers floating around this presentation, so the staff have done a great job, and I'm very grateful to them. And I think, you know, we knew during the recession we made some policy choices about the level of investment in the jobs program and in the services, which are really the services that create the ability for participation. When we decreased those by half and we had only 232 case managers for a 90% caseload increase, we knew we were going to struggle. But we also hoped that on the other side, we would be able to work with you, which is what's happening around reinvestment in the program, re-engagement of clients, and now we're hopefully on the part, we've hopefully made good choices around our ability to avoid those penalties.
I'm going to give you a little, let me give a little help here, okay? During that time of the deep recession we were in this state, we made a conscious decision that we had to support these families. They took money out of the jobs program to do that because there were no jobs to place these people in. You could have put all kinds of effort and money into it. We would have families out in the street. We would have had all kinds of social and probably crime problems. And I thought we made a very logical decision to pull back on the jobs program and put money where it was really needed for those 2 or 3 or 4 years. Now that we're going the other direction, we're starting to talk about let's put the money back in the jobs program, let's get people back to work. I think this committee and this director helped us make that very difficult decision, and I think our federal partners hopefully understand why we did that. Oregon was one of the deepest states as far as unemployment was concerned at that time. What works in New York City doesn't work so well in Malheur County. When you have no jobs available, you can have people trained as much as you want to. You can have all kinds of coaching going on, and there just wasn't any jobs. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to congratulate you on the decision you made that time to save families that were really in peril. We did the right thing, and I'm not ashamed of that. We are now turning the other direction. I think the federal government understands we weren't trying to shirk our responsibility of trying to place people in jobs. They just weren't any jobs. That's changed, and we're changing with it now. So I appreciate the work you did in the last 4 or 5 years. Of very difficult decisions we had to make then, painful decisions. Well, I think we did the right thing. There wasn't a question there.
Are you wanting us to have tears, or I mean,
no,
they did
I'm
a good job.
Explaining, I'm explaining
yeah, no,
what we
good.
Did.
They did good.
I'm proud of what we did.
Yeah, absolutely.
Madam Chair, that's one of the challenges yeah. that's constantly being faced, where you have dollars that are coming in from the feds, who tend to, you know, have sweeping rules and regulations that affect all 50 states, and then all 50 states are not alike, both in where the economy is and other aspects, and so those challenges is how we actually are able, you know, to utilize those dollars and take care of the citizens within our own borders, and it is challenging, particularly when our unemployment rate was a lot higher than some other parts of the country. The other thing that's challenging, and that's why I asked for the stats on the single heads of household and what that really looks like, you know, because your actual demographics can be different. So, you know, I too want to just weigh in of the decisions that we made, that were made. They were made on behalf of Oregonians, and then we prayed that the federal government would understand.
Thank you. Thank you. And this afternoon, the policy committee will be hearing from a national expert from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. And one of the slides, well, we could maybe forward her slide deck to this whole committee, looks at the TANF program nationally and its performance, and then compares Oregon's performance. And the conclusion that they've reached is that Oregon's TANF program outperformed for Oregonians during the recession as compared to other TANF programs in other parts of the country, just as providing that critical function. And now they're, of course, on board with the recommendations that we're making to turn it, to turn the leaf in the recovery and move in the direction that we're moving. So I think that's some nice validation for all of us that we're working on those tough policy decisions around trying to do the right thing for people and also maintain the integrity of the program. What's coming up next, we have the TANF reinvestment proposal, which we'll talk more about later. This is a program that is included in the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act and is part through our, particularly that jobs component, not the totality of the program, but the portion of the program that focuses on skill development and employment training. We have been working really hard with those partners to create alignment so that we're not duplicating and we can track outcomes and share accountability for results. And we have some really exciting things happening, one in Southern Oregon and Co-Chair Bates's neck of the woods around shared contracts so that there can be a full continuum of service that is not duplicative. So I'm really proud of the work our local teams are doing to partner with those local workforce investment boards and create job opportunity for TANF consumers in those communities that are aligned with their economic development strategies, which is a really important piece for us. And that's those last two bullets, the statewide workforce system redesign. Employment-related daycare. We serve about 8,000 families, which is over 15,000 children, with this program. So in essence, we've been trying to sort of bring you through the continuum. And for families leaving TANF, the ability to have childcare, subsidized childcare, is one of the things that makes the difference for them around their ability to go back to work. And even when we've had this program, which is a program that is inside a budget box, we have prioritized families leaving TANF to receive the services so that we're not, by virtue of the budget box that's around this child care subsidy program, creating a, yet another barrier for TANF families to leave. This is a program we're also excited about the conversations that are happening this legislative session. You can see that parents financially participate in this program. They do pay co-pays. Sometimes the providers choose not to collect those. We know that, depending on the relationship and the provider's financial status. This is a program that really has this, to me, sort of a multidimensional impact. It impacts the children in their ability to be in programs that are providing quality services. It impacts the parents and their ability to work, and it impacts the providers who provide the service and their ability to have employment around the child care industry. So lots of impact here. We partner with the Early Learning Division, which regulates child care providers and also, of course, is working on improving quality with us around this program. And so it's another one of those programs that crosses agency lines and is an important service to Oregon families. Some highlights: we've increased the number of families accessing quality licensed care. Of course, families have choice in this program, but many families have not before had options like being able to choose a higher quality setting. And for some of these children whose parents are working a lot, having a setting where there can be a lot of enrichment activity and development is very beneficial to them and their ability to be ready for kindergarten. We're also working with those family friends and neighbors, that important part of that child care continuum, to be able to support them to provide quality child care in a non-licensed setting as well. We have partnered around grants so that we can measure and be able to demonstrate for you all return on the investment in quality child care around results for school readiness. And we have lots of new partnerships going on to ensure that children who qualify for this program also can take advantage, their families can take advantage of other programs that are of quality. I mentioned already some of the partnerships. There is federal legislation that passed in this arena, too. The feds have been busy in human services the last couple of years. I feel like this is a theme I've been talking to you all about quite a bit. And so we have new requirements coming our way that were there was an I think each of the three programs I've just spoken to has also been part of Secretary of State audits, and they've also reflected on this a bit. So we've had the program integrity audit in May of 2013. We had the TANF audit in April 2014. And fall of 2014, we had the child care audit. And each of those, you'll see recommendations from us that are working to align programs and address some of the concerns that were raised in the audits. You'll also see that last child care audit focused quite a bit on the new federal requirements and some alignment around monitoring and other things that are coming forward for you for consideration this legislative session. And of course, in the governor's budget, there was a proposal to expand access to these child care subsidies for more families, quite a few more families. The reinvestment proposal, Representative Stark getting a promotion today. I mentioned that this was coming, and I appreciate your patience as I got here. In terms of where we've talked a lot about what's driving the conversation about reinvestment. The good news is that the economy is recovering. There is a caseload decrease that we're anticipating in TANF, and the reinvestment proposal doesn't invest all of the savings from that projected caseload decrease into the TANF program, but the vast majority of it, the governor was recommending, be reinvested into the program to be able to move more families from poverty to prosperity. And so these are some of the outcomes that we are looking for in the conversation about TANF reinvestment and some of the things that we're driving to create with you. So first of all, stability of TANF families. When you asked Representative Stark, is all of the TANF reinvestment budget going back into jobs? It's not. We'll break apart some of the components of the reinvestment, but we actually are separating the job opportunity and basic skills discussion from a discussion of investment in community providers around family stability. They're really different things. You know, one is really about making sure that families have what they need to be home, to be in a home, to be able to parent their children effectively, to start to remove some of the barriers like drug and alcohol addiction or mental health issues so that they can actually go from crisis stability to work. The jobs program no longer, there was a time when it included some of those services, but we're really trying to separate them out so that we can have more clarity of purpose together around outcomes and talk differently with you about outcomes-based focus on family stability as we also then talk about an outcomes-based focus on the job training and skills development programs. So there's an investment around community partnerships and leveraging those for family stability and around shared clients. We want to make sure that the case managers have time to focus on clients, and so there is an investment in targeted and intensive case management services, particularly for families who are nearing the end of their lifetime limit for the TANF program. There is a 60-month time limit for TANF. And the recommendation from the national folks that study TANF programs everywhere is that 24 months before a family is time scheduled to lose the benefit for life, a very intensive and targeted effort is made with that family to have them exit the program so that if they need the program in the future, it's there for them. Otherwise, if they get to that full 60 months, no matter where they live in the country, it follows them, and they no longer will be able to benefit from the program. So part of the TANF redesign is around a very targeted focus on those families that are nearing that time-limited space, and we want to be able to work with them so that they aren't lost or don't suffer and their children don't suffer as a result.
Chair? Yes, Senator
Rogers. What percentage of that group is generational?
Co-Chair Nathanson and Senator Winters, I'm not sure how we would know that without a deep study. And I will say this, there is also investment proposed in the TANF reinvestment proposal to do more study of the TANF program, its impact, its benefit. We could certainly consider looking at that issue as part of that. I know that one of the very big interests is around TANF leavers, who leaves and what happens when they leave over the long term as a longitudinal focus, so that we can pay attention to that, and it might get at that very issue. But we don't ask families the question, did your parents experience poverty, et cetera, and right now we don't have the data analytic capacity to fully evaluate, to quickly evaluate that without some serious study, I think.
I raise that because, you know, we talk about in alcohol and drugs and the other portions of programs of the generational effect, you know, because we, and it's the same when we talk about abuse, neglect, and some of those other issues. So I just wondered, you know, with this one, how much of it is generational. So without having the capacity, I think we can just kind of surmise and be, you know, be somewhat some assumptions, but...
There was a study I did look at recently of children that were born between 1970 and 1990. So this is just a cohort that was looked at around the issue of chronic poverty. And what was interesting to me is that 35% of those children that were born in that window experienced poverty at some point in their life. So 35%, that's a pretty high number. But only a small minority experienced persistent and chronic poverty. Now, it doesn't quite get at your issue, but it's the closest study I've seen around, you know, how often is it that the poverty is chronic and intergenerational. I think it's not the majority, but again, we're working already with a minority of the population, so it may be a larger percentage here in the TANF program. Of course, one of the outcomes we're looking for as we make the reinvestments that we're recommending is that parents are able to better participate in work activities. Family stability will drive that. We certainly need to support them with childcare, transportation, the supports they need to be able to do that. And then ultimately, we want to be able to have parents find work that is stable and that pays. And that's something that also depends on some of these other discussions. The purple box talking about program design reduces barriers to work gets at that issue, the benefits cliff. I'll talk a little bit more about that. And lastly, we think there are some places in the program, been informed by focus groups from clients, informed by our national consultants on this effort, where we could streamline the program and make the requirements more clear for constituents that need it. This slide shows you the projected caseload levels, and in between the average caseload for 13-15 and 15-17, so the green and the purple line, is where our savings is coming from. So these are looking at forecasts and just illustrating for you why we feel like we have this ability to say that there will be savings in the program and where the dollars are coming from around the reinvestment. This is getting into a little bit more detail. I will just say at the outset that I think we believe that this conversation about the TANF redesign will be happening in two places at once. It'll be happening here with you all around the budget investments and the priorities that you see, and it's also happening in Chair Kenny Geyer's committee starting this afternoon around some of the policy changes. The redesign really is this combination of both policy and targeted reinvestment in order to achieve some of the program design elements that we're looking for and want to work with you on. So let me walk through these budget pieces just briefly. So first of all, I just want to say that we were working within a budget box as we came up with these. There are people, very smart people, that are whispering answers to me from the audience who also have other ideas. And we're very open, and we know that you may have other ideas as well about where this investment goes. But this was intended by the department as a starting point for conversation to get us talking about those outcomes that we mentioned on the previous slide around really getting people stable and ready for work and able to leave the program. So as a starting point, first of all, we would like to have more flexibility and make some investment in the opportunity to prevent people from coming into the TANF program. We are proposing an investment there around a diversion effort, if you will. Families that with one infusion of cash, maybe to pay a medical bill, maybe to deal with a single rent payment, would avoid coming onto the program entirely and be able to have their needs met in a different way. than coming onto the program and then struggling to receive the service and get off. We're mindful that that's asking for quite a bit of flexibility, and we would want to do this in with pilot programs targeting clear outcomes. But it's something that we see regularly occur. We used to have both diversion and pre-TANF programs that facilitated that for TANF clients. Those are now gone. And we believe that we could avoid some people from coming onto the caseload if we had a little more flexibility on the front end.
Ms. Kelly Seal, before we get too far, I think you used the term budget box, which is sort of inside lingo for us. Could you explain for everybody who's here?
And maybe compare that to some other programs in the department that aren't really limited by a budget box.
Coach Aaron Nathanson, kind of Ms. Byerly, thank you. So in this case, this is not an entitlement program in the sense that we have match that comes in. I mean, it is an entitlement program. If you qualify for the service, you get it. But it's not the same as a program. Let me course correct. This is not the same as a program like Medicaid when you qualify that automatically we invest general fund and receive federal fund in order for you to benefit from the program. And so during the recession, what we saw is we reached the maximum, and Mr. Moore can talk about this later, we reached the maximum of the federal block grant, and so every additional general fund dollar that we were spending on this program on people was entirely general fund. We were meeting maintenance of effort, which is required. We had met the block granted amount for the program, and so every new consumer that was needing the service and entitled to the service, I apologize for my misstatement, was then being paid for by the state. So as we see the caseload decline, this is not a situation where we have a decline in federal match. What we really have is a decline in general fund investment that will be required. And the reason I talked about it as a budget box is that when we were asked by the governor's office to do some work on this, they basically said to the agency, we would like to reinvest this amount of that caseload savings into the program. So please design your investments to meet this particular budget limit. You will not have that budget limit. Of course, you could make different, the same, additional, less of an investment, but that was the construct within which we were working, which drove some of the amounts that you see here.
Thank you. And there's another question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will freely admit this is more of a comment than a question, Ms. Kelly Seal, but I just want to make it clear to the committee that I think this is a really good idea, and there are an awful lot of families who are, you know, one illness for which they don't have earned sick time, one bad car blown radiator, one bad illness that they have to pay for their child, away from not being able to make rent payments or not being able to get to work, which then leads to them becoming unemployed, which then leads to them being on TANF. And having the flexibility to have emergency funds where you can address these needs, where people know that they can call in, where you can partner with organizations like 211 so that people call in a desperate circumstance and you can address those needs quickly, we'll do what we all want to do, which is keep as many Oregonians as possible employed and self-sufficient with just a tiny little assistance instead of a really big assistance. So I'm very supportive of these efforts, and I look forward to us having longer conversations about it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
The next piece is really looking at that issue around streamlining and simplifying the eligibility requirements, really with a focus on family connections and children. Oregon has a policy still within its program that is entitled the deprivation policy. This is something that most states have gotten rid of since welfare reform. As we have done some focus groups, we've also learned from families that what this requires of us in terms of our engagement from them is a very intrusive and difficult conversation about the child's access to parental support, a parent's absence in the home. It's one of those really technical policies that was really, I believe, sort of focused on some of the early mythology that drove to welfare reform and really trying to make sure that there was really only one parent supporting the household. If we receive your support to get rid of this particular policy, it will mean that some people qualify for the program who today do not very many, but it will also, I think, move us more toward the goal of less time with paperwork, more time with people, a more consumer-friendly process. And I think when you look at the cost-benefit, and we will have some graphs for you down the road in this around how many people this actually benefits versus the cost to have this policy be part of our eligibility requirement, you will agree with us that this is a good thing for us to get rid of. It really has, you know, contact with your, we want to have policies, and I think this state, by having a two-parent program, has agreed with the idea that we want to have policies where children have access to both their parents in place, whether the parent's in the home or not. And this policy actually creates, discourages families from having parental connections to both parents in order to qualify for the program, which doesn't make a lot of sense given the policy framework I think we've adopted. So we think it's time to get rid of that policy. The other piece to this is around the definition of relative for those relative caretaker cases. We changed the definition of relative in the child welfare program to be expanded based on feedback from communities of color who often have definitions of relative that are different than some of our blood relative definitions. We also grew out the definition to include individuals like great grandparents in the child welfare system. We have not done that in the TANF system program, and so a very small amount of that investment, $400,000 of it, is to grow that definition, to align that definition of relative to the child welfare system, again with the idea that if a relative could, with some financial support from this program for the child, support the child without the child coming into foster care and then going back home to a relative, that would be a much better outcome for everybody. Expanding the family stability services. Again, this is a program that really heavily depends on our contracted partners. And so for us, this is that piece I was talking about earlier, where we would want to leverage our connectedness with nonprofits to serve families to enhance their stability. We do this already in child welfare through the Strengthening, Preserving, and Reunifying Families program, but that program is limited to children and families who otherwise would qualify for child welfare foster care. We don't currently have investment in the TANF program that is specifically targeting services around the issue of family stability. This isn't a lot of money for 30,000 families. But it's something to get us started again in that discussion. We have a commitment in this program, much like we do on the Strengthening, Preserving, and Reunifying Families program, that we won't pay for things that other programs pay for, like mental health or addiction treatment. But sometimes we have families, quite frankly, who have other needs or who need services, parent training, family relief nurseries, other services that they cannot get without additional funding, and we'd like to be able to have some ability to contract for those services around child and family development within this program, since the program really is a children's program. The largest investment programmatically that you see here really is intended to address that issue of the benefits cliff. And I think I have a slide coming up that will highlight visually this for you. But this is there are three components to this that I'll just introduce to you today. And again, we've anticipated that in phase two of this, of our work with you, that we would need to go into a lot more detail, and there may be other ideas or other ways of doing this on the table as well. But essentially right now, what we heard when we were working on this program from a variety of sources is that the income cutoff for exiting TANF, so that issue we talked about earlier, 16 hours of minimum wage, is so low that what we create for people when they leave is we're not creating much stability. And so what happens as a result, and we've actually done a TANF exit study in the last couple of years looking at that exit cohort, is that people end up needing to come back onto the program for a variety of reasons. Their job stability was not far enough along when they left the program to be able to stay off the program. And as you guys have been talking about as a policy issue at large for the state, we have encountered that income limit creates a barrier for people to be able to leave the program. So the recommendation to the state was to actually create more of a pathway, and it gets to the issue of will their benefit amount be the same as that pathway is created. It will not. Their benefit amount will go down. But to actually raise the income limit on the back end so that families can be more stable when they leave the program and hopefully leave the program in a better place so as not to have to come back.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator.
And just so that colleagues know, there was a time in history where we did allow and did have a sliding scale to allow individuals to gradually come off so stability. And Aaron, you might want to go and dust off, and I think it was 2002 or 2003, it was another budget crisis when we discontinued and didn't have the dollars to budget for that. But we did. We did do that, recognizing that there were continued needs, and that rather than abruptly remove someone from the caseload and what have you, to provide that those gradual steps, and that was a much better way of doing it than what we do today. It's because you're right, they do come back. And so this is not a new concept for Oregon. It's something that we actually historically did. It's taken us a long time to get back and revisit it, but we did at one time. You remember, don't you, Doc, all the debates and conversation that we had surrounding it, and some of us, you know, it was really painful. To have to, because we didn't have the dollars to have to remove that. So.
Thank you, Senator Winters. And in fact, the next slide is going to talk about the benefits cliff, where we can talk about this program and others. I want to let the committee and all, especially the staff, know we have only 8 minutes left scheduled for this session today. There are a couple of additional important slides that I want to make sure we get through once we're finished studying the one that we were on. The entire budget overview, I'm very pleased to have the information available, but I'm just going to ask the committee to look at the slides. If you have questions, send them to Senator Bates and me or to Lori. We'll make sure that your questions are shared with everybody and the responses are shared. But we won't get to the slides today because I want to make sure there's ample time to finish these policy-related slides that you're explaining to us.
Thank you, Co-Chair Nathanson. I'll try to be faster.
You have 8 minutes.
So in addition to raising the income limit, and again, we appreciate that we're going to have more detailed conversation about this. The other proposals are to reduce the employment-related daycare copay for 3 months for families exiting TANF. Again, just creating an opportunity for them to have more cash in hand as they leave. Jerry already mentioned the dynamic around that first paycheck and the wait for that. And so this would be a three-month period of time where their financial contribution to their child care subsidy would be decreased if they were a family leaving TANF. And also, for a three-month period of time, we're proposing to have some transitional cash payments that would decrease. So this is once they've reached that income limit, then 3 more months of potential stability with some additional cash as well as some reduced copay, so that we can hopefully create more stability for families as they leave the program. When you look at the current earnings disregard and countable income limit with the SNAP program, essentially what we were trying to do, I apologize.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, there's been a couple slides now where, due to the magic of PowerPoint, what you see on the screen that Aaron's talking about is not replicated in the PDF document that's on OLIS. So that was back when we had the 2007-2014 data, did the same thing, and there's a couple things going on here with PowerPoints going back and forth between slides that aren't in your packet. So I will make sure we get those slides added and put into OLIS with the rest of the material. But that's what's going on, is PowerPoint magic is overriding what you can see in your PDF and OLIS.
It's probably related to some animation,
yes.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So I think what it means is even though it's pretty cool for presentations, if you're going to make a PDF, it doesn't work. You have to give us access to the actual presentations.
Co-Chairs, Representative Nathanson, we do apologize. This is a new thing for us to try and leverage this technology as well, so we're learning and we appreciate your patience. So this is where we are today, and this is what we are hoping to be able to achieve with the proposals that we're putting forward. And again, this is really about helping people to be as stable as possible. When we looked at the combined impact of what we're proposing in the SNAP program, we're barely getting people to 100% of the federal poverty level with those two things put together, even with this proposal. But it's so much better than where we are today. And our hope is that with that connection to ERDC and with some of the additional investments in the ERDC program, that people will be more stable and then be able to continue through some of our SNAP education and training programs, et cetera, to elevate their skills and opportunities so that we can continue to move them up the income ladder. I do want to mention, and you saw on the slide three here, this issue around program capacity, the strengths-based, customized, and outcomes-focused, the training, the study we talked about. This is a bundled set of services for us, for our partners. I will mention a couple things about that. One of them is that you've heard me talk about moving to performance-based contracts. As we've been meeting with the Nonprofit Association of Oregon and some of the nonprofit partners, we've been hearing from them that as the state is moving more and more in this direction, they too need some support and enhanced capacity to be able to do this. We included some of that in this budget as a proposal for you to consider. So for them and for us to be able to streamline and move in this direction, we need some enhanced support. We have the piece in there also about the study so that we can make sure that as we're innovating and changing the program, we're testing our theory and getting results. The third piece is around training. We're actually asking people to work differently with customers in this approach, not just our staff, but also the people we partner with that are working with our staff. And we've heard loud and clear from those partnerships that we need more shared training together so that we can be on the same page and leverage better results. And lastly, this slide is a highlight around the issue of case management. And I talked about the fact that this proposal does include an investment in some targeted intensive case management services focusing on those individuals that are getting near to their lifetime time limit. We think that's an important conversation to have with you around the state's capacity to interact with those people more effectively so that we can help them avoid the penalty of losing the program for life. What this is intended to show is the results that you got for the reinvestment in case management that was made in this last biennium, and you can see the impact on job placements relative to the increase of case managers. There's definitely a proportionate impact because we asked them to focus there on and do that work.
So I want to ask a question about tracking. What people do, how they spend their time, following outcomes and figuring out are we getting the results that we invested in. As we need to keep better track of outcomes and better track of what we're spending our time on, are we asking people to spend proportionately more time on what we call paperwork? It's probably an electronic document, not literally paper. I hope it's not always literally paper. Are case managers or other positions needing to spend more of their time on tracking, or have we gotten better at how we keep track of that information so that it's how much investment do we have to make in time lost working with clients to keep track of the client outcomes?
Co-Chair Nathanson, I'll take a run at this and I'll let Jerry back me up. I think two things are really important about what you're mentioning. First and foremost, we've made some important shifts in terms of workload and responsibility for our case managers in the last 2 years. During the recession, when we were in that crisis state, we had case managers spending approximately 80% of their time on eligibility. We've recently shifted away from that for them so that they can focus on client contact, client engagement. We retrained them around the issue of client engagement. And in addition, we've had a targeted focus of our, what we call our lean leaders, our lean daily management effort around the TANF program in terms of the paperwork effort that's involved to try and reduce it. So we've had several things that staff have brought forward to us as ways to eliminate waste in process that we've been working on implementing statewide around the TANF program in terms of intake and ongoing case management. So we're ever mindful and really working toward that goal of as much time with people as possible. And certainly the audit also raised for us this issue of there are barriers in our IT systems for people around narratives and case. You know, I think there's this vision people have that we should be able to do a narrative, and then our systems are so sophisticated that we could automatically pick from all of those narratives whether someone's in intergenerational poverty or everything. And unfortunately, that's just not the way that our old legacy systems work. In the reinvestment proposal, we did not propose at this time new technology or new technology advancements, but it's something down the road that we do hope to continue to think with you about. But we have a firm commitment to the business process improvement and streamlining so we can maximize the time and value we're getting for the people you invest in.
Thank you.
And Co-Chair Nathanson, I actually have more detail if you're interested in that, and we could certainly meet and discuss what we're doing around some of the CEI sheets. Our what we call OIC, Operations Improvement Committee, where line staff and management staff meet to try to improve our processes so we can have more client-facing time and less time spent on that paperwork.
Really glad to hear that.
Great, me too.
Thank you.
So, Co-Chair, I think you said you would want folks to go through the budget on the slides themselves. Did I hear you correctly?
That's right, because we've reached the limit of our meeting time today.
And this is just a summary slide. I do thank you so much for the great questions on the time, and we look forward to deeper discussion with you about all of these issues in the coming months.
Thank you all for being here.
Any last comments from the Co-Chair?
No,
okay. Thank you. We're adjourned.
Mm-hmm.